Good morning, everybody. It is April the 4th, and this is a public hearing. I'd like to open the Senate Bill 5524. And Mr. Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a public testimony day for things that have been covered so far in the HEC presentation. So student financial aid, Oregon Opportunity Grant, Oregon Promise, workforce programs, private post-secondary programs, public testimony for Community College Support Fund and Community College generally, I think will likely be next Monday, and then the week after for the same type of thing for the university public support, as well as the specific statewide specials in public universities will probably be the following Monday or Tuesday. So we're limiting the testimony today to that focus on financial aid, post-secondary and workforce programs, and the various pathways and transition programs. So with that, Mr. Chair, we have not too many people signed up, so we won't use the timer. I will keep track of time here a little bit, and if you start running quite a bit, I'll signal to the chair and he may interrupt, but we don't need to do 2 minutes or anything like that today. But also, please keep in mind, don't talk too long. So with that, go.
Okay. First panel will be Mark Matsui, Jessica Howard, and Kathy Kemper. Good morning, Mr. President. Go ahead.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Monroe and members of the committee, my name is Mark Matsui. I'm the current president of Portland Community College, which is the largest higher education institution in the state of Oregon. We have 80,000 students. And prior to coming here, I served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Community Colleges at the U.S. Department of Education and had the opportunity to see the positive impact that community colleges have on workforce development in this country. And I am proud to say that community colleges have a tremendous impact on economic development through workforce development all across the country, but particularly here in Oregon. Employers know that they will go where skilled labor is, and the community colleges play a really key role in developing skilled labor pools. For a lot of different reasons, our community colleges have a very strong relationship with employers across the state through what are known as advisory councils. So every workforce development or career and technical education program has to have a advisory council. Basically employers that help us identify what to teach, as well as what kind of outcomes they're looking for, what kind of skills they would like in their future employees. Employers, we note, are asking for more complex skills every year. And entry into the middle class has never been higher. Georgetown Center for Workforce Education Research indicates that by 2020, two-thirds of all jobs will require post-secondary education and training. And in addition to providing that education and training, community colleges are valuable for a variety of different work-based learning opportunities, ranging from apprenticeship to paid internships to the actual hands-on learning that occurs in the community colleges. All across the country and here in Oregon, too, the community colleges actually bring a significant amount of federal funding to the workforce development system. Approximately one-third of the Pell program, which is about $9 billion annually, goes to workforce development in community colleges. The return on that investment in the state investment is actually, we believe, quite high. So, for example, for PCC grads, in the career and technical education programs, for every dollar they invest, they receive a $7.10 return. And to state government, In one particular year, our graduates generated almost $183 million in additional income tax revenue due to the increased education and training impact on their earning power. A recent national study confirms that the more post-secondary education through an associate's degree that graduates earn in terms of credits, then the more likely they are to increase their earning and wage power. So I do want to finish maybe with a couple of I'll take that.
Don't worry about it.
Stop her. Okay.
What's it supposed to sound? Keep going.
I didn't know if a trap door was going to open. So I did want to give a couple of examples. We have a microelectronics program. We produce about 30 grads a year. In this year, 2017, though, and we work with Intel, we work with Lam Research, we work with a variety of different companies, they actually had about 300 openings that that they had available. If we had more funding, if we had additional equipment, we could probably triple our output. We just don't have the funding right now. There's a machine called an etcher that our students need to be trained on, that it's used in the industry. And if we had more equipment, we'd be able to train more students. We also have a great partnership with Caterpillar. And it's called Think Big, and we train technicians for Caterpillar dealerships. We're starting a new program, an electric power generator technician. You know, hospitals, server farms, you know, they all have to have these emergency power sources. We're kind of pulling things together, scraping together to start the program. We could ease, and we're going to grow enrollment by 75% in this program by doing this, but we could easily double those numbers or even triple them. So those are just a couple of examples, but it all comes down to students. A student by the name of April Long is a great example of somebody who had a middle school education, dropped out, came to PCC to complete her GED, had a family, went out and worked as a gas station attendant for a while, came back and entered the Aviation Airframe Power Plant Program, and did an internship at Boeing, graduated, has a family wage job, is doing very well. And so what the community colleges, as you know, are all about is helping more Aprils. And with more funding, we know we can help more Aprils.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Howard?
Co-Chair Smith-Monroe, Smith-Warner, sorry, and Monroe, and members of the committee. I'm Jessica Howard. I am the campus president for Portland Community College Southeast Campus. Community colleges, as you know, are valued institutions of post-secondary education in our state. And this reality often conjures up images of classroom teaching and learning and transcripted credits in line with the university model of operation. Like many of you, this was my educational experience. What may be less understood is how community colleges engage with employers and industry to meet area workforce needs. And these efforts often mean that we're providing education in a variety of formats. Credit, career, and technical education is generally the most understood of these formats. And these programs, as President Mitsui mentioned, require advisory committees that are made up of local business and industry representatives, which help to develop and guide these programs of study to ensure that they meet current business, industry, labor, and professional employment needs. They also help adjust curriculum, establish internships. They assist with job placement. At PCC alone, we have over 250 different employers who serve on our career technical education advisory committees. Community colleges also engage in incumbent worker training, in which customer students receive the training for professional license renewals, recertification, or additional certifications to remain viable in their work, such as in the health professions. Think of nurses, EMTs, and the like. Or in which employers require group training in such topics as safety, computer skills, leadership training. All of this is driven and defined by industry need. In certain cases, as with the Caterpillar example that President Mitsui mentioned, we have in-depth relationships with a particular employer in which it's not simply a cohort or a class, but an entire program that is developed in response to an industry's need. Many community colleges also offer apprenticeship programs in accordance with BOLI standards, in which classroom instruction is provided to apprenticeships, to apprentices who are engaged in on-the-job training. Industrial mechanics and millwrights and various electrician apprentices are trained at PCC. And in doing so, the college has met the needs of at least 150 employers in the past 2 years. Small businesses and community colleges share a common goal of building a sustainable economy and a prosperous citizenry, and the Oregon Small Business Development Center network is the nexus of this great collaboration. Every community college in Oregon hosts a small business development center, each of which supports small business by offering training and mentorship, market research, and help accessing capital. These services are provided to small businesses, including assistance for minority women and veteran business leaders, for free or very low cost. As you are no doubt aware, small business is a key driver of local, regional, and state economies. In 2016, Oregon Small Business Development Centers helped create almost 1,000 new jobs and the retention of over 1,000 jobs that existed statewide. So community colleges are not just educational institutions in the traditional sense. They provide the foundation for workforce in local communities, and all of this is the result of our close relationships with employers, business, and industry. As you are contemplating this difficult budget cycle, I hope you will consider all the opportunities for the state when you fund community colleges to the fullest extent possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Senator Monroe, Representative Smith Warner, and committee. I'm Kathy Kemper Pell. I'm the president of Rogue Community College, representing Josephine and Jackson counties. And I'm going to take a little bit different tactic here, because back in 1973, I chose to attend a community college. And it was because I had no support from my family to attend college whatsoever. Wasn't a lack of ability, but a lack of funding and support. And many of our students today are in that same boat. They're bright, they're driven, but they don't have the resources or the family support to either financially or emotionally give them what they need in order to be successful. So that choice for me meant being the ability to transfer to a university, to graduate without debt, to go to work, and to, you know, be able to be a productive taxpaying citizen that was not burdened by massive amounts of college loans. And it's a future that we want for our students today. Now, here I am many years later. Never would have imagined in 1973 that I would be here as a college president. But I see our students struggling under the burden of financial debt, student inability to find funding for not only tuition, but books and housing is the number one reason why our students leave us. And they leave us doomed to low-paying jobs that really don't pay a living wage. And in our part of the state, what we're seeing is a huge skills gap. As I go out and talk to our business and industry leaders, they have hundreds of unfilled jobs that they are having to look out of state to find qualified people to fill those jobs. And so getting our students in a financial situation where they can afford to go to college and fill those jobs locally is critically important to us. We have seen, since I went to community college, an 1,800% increase in community college tuition and a 600% increase in the cost of textbooks. That is astounding and certainly can't be attributed to the cost of living. We, in order to maintain community colleges as the economic engines in our communities, as both my colleagues here have described for you, it's imperative that we provide financial support to these colleges so that we can hold down costs. If we continue to pass on our costs in college tuition, we will make community college unaffordable. And our local businesses will have to look out of state for the talent to fill their positions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for coming up this morning all the way from Grants Pass.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. The next panel will be Travis Rowdy, Tom Cope, and Charlie Hopewell.
Co-chairs, Representative Senators, thank you very much for allowing us from Oregon Youth Conservation Corps to take a few minutes of your time this morning. As the co-chair, volunteer co-chair, it's part of my responsibility is to speak on behalf of OYCC, and I'm thankful that we have this opportunity here.
And Oregon Youth, you need to put your name on the record.
Okay, I'm sorry, Thomas Cope, C-O-P-E. I've retired, I've volunteered with various organizations through the years. For the last 5 years, I've been volunteering with Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. I'm also a strong and firm believer in education, having graduated community college and a few universities through the process. It's OYCC is a program that's very near and dear to my heart. I have children myself, two boys, but at the same time, it's for students who are at risk out across this state, who are struggling to try to graduate from high school in many ways. And at the same time, the program that we provide gives workforce skills. If you were to read through the annual report that we've given you, you'll see some of the statistics, but at the same time, you'll see some of the comments from the participants. And it's great to have Travis here this morning to be able to actually speak to that as a representative and a graduate from OYCC. Our funding actually comes from the amusement device tax, so we're stable funded, although at the same time, we've been stable funded in a program founded in 1987. And over time, with inflation, the amount of students that we're able to reach through our program has declined. Last year alone, we had nearly 46% of the students who applied to become part of our program, which puts youth out onto trails, helping to cut trails, to fix our national parks, to work with museums and other service work in the communities. Only 46% that have applied were able to actually become part of our program. So we are flat funded and we're actually losing the ability to serve. So if there isn't any kind of an opportunity, and I know this is a very difficult time for the budget here in the state, it would be much appreciated if we could see some support, more support coming for OYCC. I think that's really all I have to say, unless you have any questions that you'd like to ask before Travis has a word here.
Your program basically was patterned after the CCC from the Great Depression, isn't that correct?
I believe that's true, very similar. It puts, as I said, youth out there in our communities to do service work at the same time as they're learning, getting the degree or the credits that they need to help them graduate from high school as opposed to leaving and dropping out. So very similar in that regard.
Yeah, the difference would be that the CCC, because of the economic situation back in the 30s, was open to mostly urban, but all young men. They weren't necessarily what we call troubled or in
right.
danger like the young men that you serve are.
Right.
So a little different program, but the same kind of activities, building trails and
right.
Good outdoor work.
Right. Right. And I think one of the benefits really of the program too is that many of the youth who are out there on our programs, particularly during the summer, actually get a stipend or a wage, and that is the first time they really have an opportunity to earn money, and often it will go to help their families in situations where it's vital.
Yeah, and the CCC, they right. got paid a little bit too, but I believe that half of everything they got paid had to be sent yeah. back to their family,
yeah.
who were often starving.
Yeah, right. Yeah. right.
Travis.
Co-Chair Monroe, Smith Warner, members of the committee. My name is Travis Roundy. I am a manager for Ant Farm, which is a nonprofit located in Sandy, Oregon. I was born and raised in Sandy, Oregon. I was something of an at-risk youth myself, I would say. Ant Farm has a Youth Corps program, which is one of the programs that I manage, which works on OYCC projects, so we receive funding from them. We've been able to employ nearly 300 youth at this point through those projects over the last a little over five years now. Not all of the youth employed were through OYCC, but a great many of them. It for me personally, it was a great opportunity to get a little bit more in touch sort of with what was going on around me, become connected with people. I started out just volunteering for Ant Farm, and then a project came up and they were able to hire me on. I found definitely a lot of discipline and a lot of accountability within that program. And since then, I have personally continued down that path. Explored some individual trail building projects, but I've remained with Ant Farm because I see the direct correlation of effect in the community and young people with what our organization is doing and in support, with the support of OYCC. I've personally witnessed multiple people that I grew up with have worked with Ant Farm or worked with OYCC projects, and they've continued on in those fields which they were able to explore due to those projects, and have found full-time, you know, career paths in that. Sandy is a small rural town. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with it, but definitely doesn't have a large economic boom of any sort going on. As was mentioned, the ability for young people to get that first-time employment, I mean, it's oftentimes you're looking at fast food, gas station, so on, and the exposure to what more there is directly around us has been incredibly, incredibly powerful for me to witness personally as a young person growing up in it and now in the position that I'm in, looking at more of the statistics to it, looking at a little bit more of the financials to it, and being able to see the kind of broader scope. It's been an incredible experience for me. I've witnessed it be an incredible experience for many young people now. And I will say, you know, Ant Farm as a whole, there isn't a particular criteria to whom we're working with. And so that's one of the things that I've seen to be incredibly effective and very beautiful to what's going on there is, you know, you have certainly at-risk youth being served and being provided these skills, but they're working alongside other folks that, you know, may not fall into that criteria. But it's a display that we can all use a little bit of support, and we can all use a little bit of direction. And when we come together in that, and you've got kid coming from a troubled life and kid coming from a golden home, you know, they find some sort of symmetry in what they're experiencing. And it's helped definitely in my personal witness to break away some of the barrier that exists in a small rural community that, you know, you've got poor and not poor, and there's all sorts of what have you judgment in that, and to witness a little bit of the deterioration of that has been a very powerful and beautiful experience to participate in.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Mr. Hopewell.
Good morning, co-chairs Smith Warner and Monroe. I'm Charlie Hopewell. I've been a businessman in Oregon for 35 plus years, but today I'm actually speaking to you as a member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. In preparation for my comments this morning, first of all, it'd be very difficult to talk about the OWIB in 7+ minutes, so let me try to figure out a way to actually put some highlights with our partners, that many of which are sitting behind me. At OWIB, the vision is prosperous communities are fueled by skilled workers, quality jobs, and thriving businesses. That's our mission. And we do that, then, through the various ways. For any of you that are not aware, my comments today perhaps are less about asking for increased funding. Of course, in this legislative session, that would be difficult at best. But also for some advocacy on your part in regarding how OWIB touches Oregonians throughout the state. If you're not aware, effectively the OWIB resides as a body to help the governor and advise the governor in regard to workforce investments throughout the state. The bulk of the funding comes from the federal level, and then we are the conduit then out to the various areas. Under the OWIB structure, we also have the work of the local workforce development boards, of which there are now 9 regions within the state. Through the repatterning and repositioning that we did a couple of years ago. And we operate under a strategic plan that then was put together, and I was lucky to be a part of that in the last couple of years, literally through every community within throughout the state of Oregon, balancing the broad needs of the workforce and the population within the state of Oregon, economic, regional, cultural, and that is also supported then through the HEC, through some state funding, of which you are touching in your considerations. Under our strategic plan, effectively, we are dealing with two primary customers, those that are seeking opportunity and those that have opportunity. And what's become clearer and clearer is that as a business-driven enterprise through our membership and so forth, we've done, I think, a better job of really trying to focus on these two primary customers in how we actually deploy the services to increase Oregon's workforce. If you didn't understand through Portland Community College's earlier testimony, you could see this happening throughout the state. The diversity of Oregon is amazing. When I think of the far eastern region, which covers literally from south to north to the eastern border of Oregon, and I look at the work that this particular region is trying to do a coordinated approach towards workforce and workforce development, it's a daunting task. Not only that, but then as we look at the allocation of dollars, resources, and so forth, the process of being able to channel dollars appropriately, given far agricultural regions to urban areas within the city of Portland, for instance, and then the different populations that we need to serve, it is indeed a very complex system. What I've grown in the appreciation over the last couple of years that I've served is that the OWIB essentially, and it's really at the local workforce development boards, provide the primary service of not deploying individual services themselves, but they are collaborators. They are conveners of a community. And so as I was hearing the earlier testimony, I serve not only as a member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, but I'm also a member of the Oregon Talent Council. And then I'm a liaison with Work Systems, Inc., which is the local workforce development board in Washington and Multnomah counties. So I see the diversity of touch throughout the state of Oregon. And again, it makes me reflect on the daunting task of being able to help those that need help in the workforce on both sides, the customer side and the customer meaning the business and the customer side meaning the individual. We're no longer about just finding jobs for people. We are in the business of looking forward and trying to find the skills and talents that are necessary to drive our economy forward. Make no mistake about it. Workforce development equals economic development. My 35 plus years in this state have told me time and time again, you cannot grow without talent. We are facing in this state the same thing that's being faced throughout the country, and that is we've got an aging population. And as we have that population start exiting the workforce, our challenge gets even greater to be able to attract them. Not only that, but because of previous economic conditions, we've also sucked out an entire generation that was potentially open to looking at different kinds of careers. I happened to be in manufacturing, and because many of those programs collapsed with the economic collapse that we had in the 2000s, earlier 2000s, we lost many of the services that will be able to help that generation step into the jobs. And so we're playing catch up with that. And as I talked to some of my friends from Temecula Community College earlier, you'll hear this from any community college in the state of Oregon, literally every student has a job. Our challenge is going to be allowing them to work and also allow them to continue to learn. The advocacy that I'm asking for today from this body is to continue to support the great work of the OWIB through the HEC. The other advocacy that I'm going to ask for is that for whatever reason, WIOA is under tight scrutiny at the federal level. I'm going to personally ask you, as both a member of the OWIB, but also as a member of Oregon, for your advocacy, talking to our representatives at the federal level and helping them understand the criticality of workforce development and that need for economic development within our state. We cannot step away from the efforts that are being done. So in lieu of time, I'd like to be able to answer any questions that I could, but I would also call your attention. I think we've done extensive work of trying to find ways that we can actually track the work of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is available on our website. We're driving hard to find metrics that are easily understood to allow us to be able to reflect quickly on our success or failures. And by the way, there will be failures, but also in the manufacturing world, failures equal learning. Learning equals opportunity. Please give the Oregon Workforce Investment Board your due consideration for continuance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next people up will be Lamar Wise and Tony Erickson.
And Mr. Chair, members, if there is anyone else in the audience that wants to testify, please sign up on the sheet now so we know what there is.
Good morning.
Morning. I'm a little bit short, so I had to kind of
Right. Put
you down a little bit. Senator Monroe, Representative Smith Warner, I'm members of the committee. My name is Lamar Wise, and I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. The Oregon Student Association was founded in 1975, so I think we're going on 42 years old. With that, we represent a little over 100,000 students statewide. So we are a statewide organization, and we also have a very robust voter registration program where we both register and educate nearly 50,000 students to vote statewide. And I can tell you, by traveling the state and being with students on the ground, and of course being a student myself not too long ago, that the number one issue facing students in higher education is the cost of attendance and the cost of going to higher education. And with that, we did a statewide survey and to back up that narrative, and what we found that. Every campus that we administered the survey, we surveyed about 10% of the student population or more, and the number one issue was student aid and tuition. And so with that, I also want to talk about what our students are wanting to do about this issue. And part of the solution that we came up with is asking for $155 million for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And so you may ask why we're asking for $155 million for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The reason being is that students recognize that this is a program that creates a bridge between them and their families and higher education. They see this as an opportunity to break the poverty cycles in their own families. We see this program going to the students with the most need. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is Oregon's only need-based aid, and it's also a program that time again has helped students to achieve their higher education dreams, and also a chance for them to reach back to their families and ensure that they have a pathway to higher education. Because we also know that when one student or one person in a family attends higher education or higher education institution, the whole family is affected. So by doing this, you are effectively being a part of Oregonians' families and making them better. With that being said, our students are facing a lot of issues right now. It's really hard to be a student in Oregon because of a multitude of issues. One, rising housing costs. Secondly, the rising costs of tuition, just in general, the cost of attendance. For example, textbooks. And we will also be asking you all to support open educational resources at some point in time. But with that, I just wanted to show there's a wider array of things that are affecting students cost-wise. And we also want to make sure that that's being at the forefront of your decision-making when you are deliberating on the budget. I also did have a quick student story. A lot of our students can be here this week to testify, which is the only reason why I'm here. Usually we have students in front of you, but as a lot of you may know, some teachers in some classes require you to be there for the first day or otherwise they drop you. And so we've experienced a lot of students wanting to stay in school for the first week, but you will see students at the community college and university hearings for sure. But I did want to share with you just one story. And this is a story from Candolin. And so I'll just quickly read it. My name is Candolin Johnson, and I'm a senior first-generation student, college student. I graduated from Lynn Benton Community College, and I'm finishing my last year at Oregon State University as the Executive Director of Government Relations for the student government on campus. I am a political science major who hopes to become a lobbyist, campaign organizer, or a nonprofit organizer. Today, I am testifying with my fellow students to stress the importance of funding the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I grew up in a family of six where both of my parents, my sister, and I attend college. As of right now, I'm the only one who has transferred to OSU, but I will not be the last one in my family to attend. My parents decided to go back to school because they found it necessary in order to improve our family's future. Education is what low-income families like mine are depending on in order to improve the quality of our lives and our future generations. This year is actually the first year that I was able to pull off not working two jobs while attending school full time because I got my current job with the student government on campus. But many students aren't so lucky and end up having to work two or three jobs to make ends meet, along with taking out a huge amount of loans. My family and I have all been grateful recipients of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. For every year that we have attended college, it has made the difference between being able to stay in school or having to take the term off to pay bills. Along with the grant, I work 20 hours a week, have applied for several scholarships, and still will be graduating in June of this year with $26,378 in debt, a small amount of debt compared to some. This is felt even more deeply with students like my parents, who live paycheck to paycheck in order to pay rent, electricity, textbooks, and food. And it troubles me to know that there are many students who, even though are qualified for the grant, do not receive it due to a lack of funding. This grant also keeps students who are barely scraping by without taking on huge amounts of debt to continue funding their education. When you When you're in student government, you start to hear students become very hopeless about their situation, and you hear the stories of hardworking students who just couldn't make it. I personally know that several students who had dropped out because they just couldn't afford to keep going to school. Students count on you to keep them from drowning in debt, which is why we're asking this committee to support funding the Oregon Opportunity Grant at $155 million. Thank you, Candlin Johnson.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Erickson, go ahead.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, and members of the committee. I am Tony Erickson, the Chief Operating Officer of Oregon Arrow, out in Scappoose, Oregon, Columbia County. I'm also privileged to serve as the chair for the Workforce Investment Board for that part of Oregon, and we cover five counties up there. I'd like to thank you, the committee, for your support of Workforce Investment Boards and dollars. We have some exciting things happening around the area. I'll jump right to it. I got involved in workforce development not because of some desire to do something meaningful in that area, but it was out of honest desperation as a company. In Scappoose, believe it or not, we have five world-class companies that supply advanced textile manufactured products to the world, and one of the primary customers is the U.S. military. And we have seen our aging workforce retire, and it's an extremely difficult position to backfill due to lack of training and lack of jobs in the area. They went offshore about 30 years ago. Bureau of Labor and Industries mothballed their apprenticeship program about 30 years ago for that sector, and it is trying very hard to come back. We in that community were stealing each other's employees, and we could see the writing on the wall, so I convened a meeting with all the business owners and said, we need to do something proactive about replacing this workforce. Fortunately, I was able to get involved in workforce development, and we now have a pilot program for advanced textile manufacturing sector there in Scappoose, and it has eyeballs on it around the state as a model of how to do something. We have got a grant from the Oregon Community Foundation to support this sector, and we are going to be buying training equipment with that. We also have applied for a grant with the Ford Family Foundation for funds for an instructor to support that. So we're actually doing stuff. It's not talk. We're actually making work happen. We are also in the early stages of a promising healthcare sector in Benton and Lincoln counties, and the feedback we're getting from our employer champion from Samaritan Health, they said that they're going to cover all aspects of healthcare, including food service, janitoria, all the way up. We're also forming a robust maritime industry sector that is taking shape along the entire coast. We have three workforce boards: Northwest Oregon Works, Lane Workforce Partnership, and the Southwest Oregon Workforce Investment Board. And we are leveraging our efforts and our funds collectively to make that happen. And the maritime industry is one of the biggest and most hidden industries in Oregon. It not only covers the coast, but Lewiston, Idaho is a seaport. It goes all the way up the Columbia River. And some estimates put it at a $20 billion a year job. And it touches, you know, longshoremen, it touches truckers, it touches so much of Oregon. So that's something that is very worthy of effort and support. And I understand that Senate Bill 867 is headed to the General Government Accountability Committee for a second hearing. That has a lot of support and a lot of stakeholders, and I know my executive director, Heather Desart, has met with Senator Roland on this topic a couple times. So thank you for your support. We're also, the Workforce Investment Board is geared up to help support the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center, or OMIC, there in Columbia County. I'm sure you've heard of that. It's the first of its kind in the United States. There are, I think, about 13 around the world, the first one in Sheffield, England. And that will support not only my company specifically, but aerospace and other large companies in the area through their manufacturing training and their involvement in research and development. And they're actually working, thankfully, with Portland Community College in a joint effort on that. So the support of these sectors is made possible through the funding from the state, and it's having a very positive impact on the local areas. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you both for your testimony. Can I ask about the companies in Scappoose that are involved in the developing the apprenticeship program? I'm assuming that in addition to the community foundation and other, that the companies themselves are also investing in that program?
Correct. Okay. Senator Monroe, Smith Warner, and committee members. Yes, we have companies you may have heard of. You may have heard of Oregon Arrow. We have Westco Boot and Shoe Company. You may not have heard of them, but they're about a 90-year-old company that is fourth, fifth generation family owned that makes some world-class footwear, movie stars and around the world, a big customer base over in Asia right now. And Michael Curry Productions, everybody has seen their work. They have done Super Bowl halftime shows, Olympic openings, Cirque du Soleil sets. Cirque du Soleil actually comes to Scappoose and practices on a private stage they have at their facilities with the equipment, the Lion King touring show, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have OS Systems and USIA, wet and dry suit manufacturers that are actually robust competitors for the U.S. military market. So we have provided space, training materials. Oregon Arrow has developed a curriculum for training these students, and we are co-sharing space with the Workforce Investment Board for actually training this workforce. Our job we see as getting skilled workers in this pilot program for the local businesses that desperately need them, not just for us but for everybody, and then taking that model to a larger level so Portland can be fed as well. We've identified 300 or 400 jobs in Portland that immediately could be filled if there were skilled workers in that area. If you expand that out to Vancouver and up to Tacoma, we've identified over 1,100 positions that would be filled immediately if there were employees available. Mm-hmm. And that's just over the next 4 or 5 years, we're looking at a 50% retirement, perhaps. I mean, it's a high number. So,
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I always appreciate having OSA here. I'm old enough to remember when they had a different name 20-some years ago, and it seems like the opportunity grant is always on the to-do list for the student lobby, student association. So a couple questions about that for you. I heard you ask for the opportunity grant. Did not hear you ask anything about Oregon Promise. Does the OSA have a position on the Promise? And then are you getting any feedback from students on sort of the wraparound services that come with Oregon Promise versus we give kids who are, you know, arguably in that same need category the opportunity grant, but we also see that that's a population of students that really struggles to stay in school. You said it yourself in your testimony. So what are you seeing kind of boots on the ground as a student between the two programs, and what is OSA's position on the Oregon Promise?
Currently we don't have a position on the Oregon Promise, and the reason why is that students were afraid with the current budget climate that it just simply wasn't going to get funded. And so students decided to prioritize the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I think that you all should take that as students saying that they wouldn't want the Promise, but I would be remiss if I said that that we do want to make sure that dollars are going to students who need it the most, or students with the most need. But we definitely see value in both of those programs, and in a perfect world would have everything funded, of course. This is a topic that is also ongoing within our own organization. We would like to continue to talk about it, and as the budget climate continues to develop here, we would love to revisit it and continue to talk with you all about what you're thinking in terms of deciding how much dollars to give the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Promise. With that being said, going to your second question, which was about the wraparound services. From what I've heard, I believe the students who do receive the Oregon Opportunity or the Oregon Promise, also have to be a part of a different set of pathway programs that institutions have started to create in order to see students through community college and make sure that the dollars that were spent on the Oregon Promise is being used wisely and that students are going through quickly. I think students have appreciated that and have really appreciated that type of program set up. to be able to rely on helpful advising services to get them through community college with as little deviation as possible. I think it, from what I've heard, has been helpful.
Go ahead.
So are you finding on the university levels, because, so, I mean, I received an opportunity grant years ago, and we heard testimony yesterday about, you know, transference of credits, and I went to multiple colleges to before I finally got my undergraduate, and, you know, you need 180 credits for a bachelor's degree, or that's at least that's what I needed years ago, and I think I wound up with 221 credits, so quite a few extra that I didn't need in that mix, and I continue to hear that as a problem from students, and so do you find that, particularly if you're on, you know, a high-need financial aid, that you're getting those services at the universities, that same type of guidance, if you're not an Oregon Promise student, but if you are, you know, a high-need financial aid using the Opportunity Grant, because we weren't years ago, and I don't know if that's changed, and I'm curious what your perspective is on that.
So, just to clarify, so you're asking if the universities, like, continue to have a lot of those services that are being provided for the Promise?
Yes.
Okay. I can't speak for every university. I don't know which what types of processes and services that they do provide. I did attend the University of Oregon, where they did provide a lot of advising services, and I would say they were very open and available, which was helpful to me when I was going through. Again, I can't speak for everyone, but at least at the U of O, I know that that they did prioritize having advisors available, and specifically they had there was a department called the Center for Multicultural Excellence, and they had advisors specifically for folks from marginalized communities, and that was really helpful to me to go to advisors that looked like me, that had similar experiences that I had as I was going through higher education. So I think that's something that's also really important to and to keep in mind when sending dollars to institutions for advising is the type of advising that gets done.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on the HEC budget? Not seeing anybody jump up. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you
coming. Mr. Wilson?
Tomorrow, again, Mr. Chair, members, we'll be back with HEC's presentation. 2 days of community colleges, the first by the commission staff, the second day will be turned over to the community college, local community college people, presidents and others. And then, as I said before, it looks like public testimony day for community college programs will be next Monday.
Okay, and on your OLIS, there is a letter from a Dave Porter. Is Mr. Porter here? Not seeing him. He's in my district, and he contacts me quite frequently. Anyway, for the record, his presentation is on the OLIS, and you can read it at your leisure. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Porter has been a strong advocate for more language, especially for years, and
I
appreciate his efforts.
Yes, I've talked to him several times. I have a grandson who's been in the Chinese immersion program for like 9 years, and Mr. Porter is always advocating for more language immersion programs. We need more good citizens like that. Okay? We are adjourned until tomorrow.
Thank you very much.